There are a lot of things I don't like about being 45 and not 25 anymore. My body doesn't work the way it should, and things are changing. But you know, there's something that's really great about being 45. I look back on my life and I can see that God is changing me. That where I didn't hunger and thirst for righteousness, in fact, where I hungered and thirsted just for Christine, now I want God more. I like seeing that change.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Years ago when I was in high school, there was a youth group that came into our schools and was trying to get kids together to learn about God. The leader of that group really pursued me. And I was really pursuable because I had a heart that really wanted to know and understand and learn about God. I was also pursuable because that group really spoke to some of the things that I hungered and thirsted for, which was popularity. And it seemed like I could get popular not only in the kind of secular part of the school by doing certain things, but I also could be popular in this other group and have them kind of surround me through being involved with them. And I'd say a couple of years after I was involved in it, at the end, my youth leader said that one of their strategies to get other kids in was to get the popular kids in the school, the cheerleaders, the football players, that, you know, the kids that were kind of well known in the school, to come into their group, and then other people would follow. I was really hurt by that. I felt, and I think I was, really used. But I only could have been used. I mean, I was really angry about it. Like, that was really bad that they did that. But when I thought about it later, I realized that the only way that I really could have gotten used was because I was willing to, because I also wanted the popularity. They were giving me what I wanted. I hungered for the popularity, and that's what I got. We've been looking at the Beatitudes and in our quest to understand what is true biblical spirituality, and we're on verse 6 of Matthew 5, and it says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." That speaks so clearly to my experience. It's the opposite of it. I didn't hunger and thirst for righteousness, and I certainly wasn't satisfied. It's taken years and years for God to change my heart so that I want righteousness rather than popularity, or I want it at least more than that.
It might be good to actually take this beatitude together with two verses down from there. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. I think they kind of work together in Jesus' thinking here. The one is talking about our craving for righteousness, and then he's going on a little later when he mentions the pure in heart to talk about how single-minded our craving for righteousness is. That is, we hunger and thirst for righteousness to the exclusion, really, of anything else. It's unadulterated, it's uncorrupted, it's unmixed with other motives and other desires and other hungers and so on. When James later in his letter talks about the pure in heart, he contrasts it with double-mindedness, where we're kind of two minds. I want righteousness, yes, but not if I have to sacrifice this over here to get it. Which, and that your story brought that to mind, because on the one hand, there was a part of you, as I understand what you just described, that did want to follow God, to know God, that thirsted after God, but at that stage in your life, not to the exclusion of being popular at school. And that's the dilemma that most of us face. I mean, it's not like most of us don't have any interest in God at all. It's just that we like God on our terms, not on His terms, and that's where we run into trouble. Because His terms are that we bow to His purposes completely, bow to His purposes utterly without compromise, that we want what He wants and only what He wants, and if we have to sacrifice everything else to have it, that's ultimately okay with us. That's what it means to be a child of God. That's what it means to hunger and thirst after righteousness.
But Jack, we never get there. Right? We never get to the place where we're just single-minded, where we just don't have a sense of, it doesn't matter, whatever I give up, I'm not going to struggle with that, because what I want only is righteousness. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
This is telling on myself kind of in a bad way, but recently my husband and I have been talking about the possibility of selling the place that we're in and moving to a smaller place, because it's just a lot to keep up for us. And I kind of jumped at that. Like, oh, huh, what a relief, you know, this getting into a smaller place would be so much easier. And was just kind of basking in that possibility. And then something surprising came to me. I was sitting in my garden looking at it. It's really quite beautiful. And I thought, oh, I don't want to lose this. This is giving me some significance. People come here. People had just been there and said, this is a gorgeous garden. And I realized in my heart, I didn't even know that this was giving me some significance. But in thinking about giving it away or selling it, all of a sudden, I find this intent of my heart that I am a person who is, in a sense, still wanting to be popular through a different means. I'm willing to give it up. It's not as though I'm holding on to it and unwilling to even see. I mean, even my willingness to see what was going on there, I think, is evidence of some growing maturity in me. But I'm not done. I'm not only hungering and thirsting for righteousness.
Okay, yeah, that raises a very, very important point in understanding what Jesus is saying here. I think we need to make a distinction between the kind of godliness that we will have in our glory when we have been recreated and are new people and are new creatures in the kingdom of God. The kind of righteousness that will be so intuitive and so spontaneous, it'll just be instinctive to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying we never get to, and that's right. That we will never get to that point in our lives here and now. It just isn't going to happen. Because there are always going to be conflicting desires, desires that are contrary to what is right and good, that will really have a pull on us, really have a tug on us. And even desires that are just downright perverse at times are going to be attractive and interesting to us here and now in this lifetime. In that sense, we never arrive at any kind of righteousness worthy of the name. But Jesus is not describing here moral perfection, I don't think. And that, we haven't commented on that. That's important to see. I don't think he's talking about moral perfection here. He's talking about the commitments in the heart of a true child of God. In the midst of our sin, in the midst of our brokenness, in the midst of our struggle with our own moral depravity, we can nonetheless fit the description that he's describing here. So, what does it mean to hunger and thirst for righteousness? It doesn't mean that we won't feel the attraction of other things. It's not that we won't feel other cravings, but that the commitment of my heart is willing to set those aside in order to do what's right, in order to aim at the goal of righteousness. So the fact that you could describe yourself as, I'm willing to give it up, is not insignificant. I mean, that's a very, very, very significant fact about you. If you are willing to give it up, as much as it is attractive to you, as much as it's interesting to you to keep it and to hold on to it, the fact that you would be ultimately willing to give it up for the sake, let's say that it is for the sake of righteousness, pure and simple, and not convenience or any other motives as well, but if it were for the sake of righteousness that you're willing to give it up, then that would be a clear indication that there's something really different about you that is not true of the typical human being in the world. The commitment of your heart is, if I have to give up anything, if I have to give it up in order to pursue righteousness, then I want to do that, because righteousness is the real craving of my life. So we won't always do it gracefully. I mean, sometimes we'll give it up kicking and screaming because this other thing is really interesting to us. But the fact that we are going to give it up, even kicking and screaming, means that righteousness is even more important than these other things are to me. I don't think that'll be true in the kingdom of heaven. In the kingdom of heaven, we will pursue righteousness never kicking and screaming, because it'll just be so instinctive and intuitive to us.
So the real difference for me in high school and now is significant. In high school, I really don't think, I'm certain, I wouldn't have given up the popularity for God. In fact, I was using God in order to be popular in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was I really wanted the youth leaders to like me and to kind of gather around me, and they were nurturing to me, and that's kind of what I was going after. And I called it, you know, real spirituality, but it really wasn't that. And I got a lot of kudos from being in that position. I wouldn't have given it up. I maybe would have acted like I was, but my heart really wasn't there yet. And that's what God does in our hearts over time, is He brings us to a place where we can even see that that's what we want. I didn't even see it then.
Mm-hmm.
But we can see it, and that's really the beginning. And I think that really fits into what we've talked about in the Beatitudes previously, is God brings us to a place where we have an accurate perception of ourselves, and then we're willing to give it up. We're hungering and thirsting for what's good, not hungering and thirsting for what's bad.
Right. Right, and not even bad, but just not as good sometimes. I mean, many of the things that we desire and that our heart longs for are God-given desires that are perfectly normal, perfectly appropriate in their context, in the right priorities, are fine to desire. But if they take precedence over righteousness, then they become evil.
And that really fits into the example I used last week. I was talking about somebody who I really want to love me, and that's really a God-given need to be loved, especially by people who are in our families. And that's not a bad thing to go for, but I had to give up demanding it from that person because I was becoming self-righteous and hurtful toward them in trying to get them to love me in a particular way. So it wasn't a bad thing I wanted, but I had to give up that to actually have a humble spirit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's what life is all about, is that it, often we are called upon, we are required by the circumstances that God puts us in to give up things that are good things, good and right and appropriate things, things that I rightly desire, but it's not going to be.
And even feel like I need.
And need, yeah.
But what I need more is righteousness.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what he's talking about, is to come to that sense of the priority of righteousness, so that righteousness is more important than any other need in my life. I set that as a goal above and beyond every other goal, such that I will sacrifice attaining those other goals in order to lay hold of righteousness. That's the kind of hunger and thirst after righteousness, after out of a purity of heart, that he's describing, I think.
So, Jack, do you see this hunger and thirsting for righteousness in your life?
Well, I think so. As like all of these things, you know, we need to see what he's saying here, and that is, these things are manifest in actions and choices more than they are in the emotional landscape of my life. But, you know, we looked at before, blessed are those who weep. He doesn't really mean somebody who's always shedding tears, someone who emotionally is always at that place of mourning emotionally. What the reality he's trying to get at is deeper than my emotional life. It's at the bottom core of my existence. And how does that reveal itself? It reveals itself in the choices that we make. I couldn't look at my experience and say, I never see times in my life where some things are more important to me than righteousness, because that's just simply not true. But I can see enough of what God has done in my life to know that the God who has developed, who has created in me a craving for righteousness, is in the final analysis going to make that win out in my life. I'm confident that that will win out, not because I'm confident in me, but I'm confident in the author of my being, the creator, as someone who is committed to me and who's making that happen. And that, I think, I can safely say I'm pretty confident of that.
Okay, so can I push you further, Jack?
Sure.
How do you see that happening in your marriage?
Over the course of the years, as anyone who is married can vouch to this, that your marriage partner does not always give you what you want. They are not always the person that you would like them to be. They don't always want what you want. They don't always behave the way you would prefer that they behave in order to meet your emotional needs, your psychological needs, your sexual needs, your physical needs of one kind or another. They're just not always
everything
for you. So over the course of years, I've had to make a choice. Do I resent my wife for not being to me and for me everything that I want my wife to be? Or do I decide that what's more important to me is that I do right by her than that she gives me what I want? And particularly early in my marriage, that was a very difficult struggle at times. The temptation to be feel bitter and resentful and feel thwarted by my wife.
It must have been more than a temptation. There must have been times where you felt bitter toward her.
Well, yeah. I mean, I really struggled with that. But where I had to finally resolve it is I had to face into the question, and I think this is a part of coming to terms with righteousness, is coming to terms with God, realizing part of what I understood, I think, early on was she is who she is by God's design. I mean, you married her by the direction of God's providence. God led you to marry her. You are in this marriage by ordination from God. She is who she is because God has ordained that. So if you have a complaint, Jack, don't go to your wife, go to God. And decide before God, do you have anything to whine about, Jack? And for me, it's harder to whine to God than it is another human being. It's harder to be bitter toward God than another human being. It's not impossible, certainly, but it's harder if you realize how good he has been, how much gratitude you owe to him, how merciful he's been. In the face of all that, it's a lot harder to charge God with kind of being holding out on you and not being forthcoming and not being generous and not being gracious. We can lose sight of all of his mercy, but if we have his mercy and his grace and his goodness in view, then it's a little harder to whine about some of the what ultimately are relatively trivial things that bother us and disappoint us. So through some significant struggle, I ultimately was able to resolve it in terms of deciding, do I want to be the kind of person that God wants me to be? Do I want to be grateful? Do I want to be a servant? Do I want to be merciful? Do I want to be loving? Do I want to be kind? In other words, am I going to hunger and thirst after righteousness? Or am I not going to be satisfied until I get what I want and just demand that God meet my needs on my terms? And a big part of me wanted to demand that God give me what I want and to meet my needs on my terms.
And if you're like me, you probably spent years doing that, at least in part.
Yeah, I'd have episode after episode of revisiting that question.
Or revisiting it in the sense that you saw yourself demanding what you wanted and maybe not being kind in that demand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe being very hurtful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That lash out, hurt, try to be sarcastic, be
critical.
I'd be critical. My favorite technique was to get morose, to kind of feel sorry for myself, self-pity, and get kind of morose and depressed.
Kind of in essence say to Jody, you know, how could you hurt me so badly? If you knew how bad you hurt me, you'd change
and
be the kind of person I want you to be.
Yeah, exactly. And
oh, that's pretty, Jack. Aren't we pretty?
Oh, yeah. We're just downright cute.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I've had episode after episode after episode. Actually, now that you mention it, I am more mature than I was.
Now that I mention it?
As I think about it.
You're not
as
morose.
I haven't even noticed, but I don't do that as often.
Okay, so come on. You had this faraway look in your eyes, and you went, share with us. What are you looking
at? I was just thinking about how frequent it used to be that I would do that and how relatively infrequent it is now. I just hadn't occurred to me that I hadn't actually made any progress there, but I think I probably have.
It's encouraging to look a little in the net
sometimes. To get some perspective
on your
life. Yeah.
Yesterday, we're driving in the car home from church, and my daughter said to me, "Hey, Mom, the pastor sent too. So should I give her this tape?"
Yeah.
Of course, I said, "Of course, Leah, Pastor Sin. Your dad used to be a pastor."
Yeah, that clutches it.
That really did. Oh, is your dad Sin? Yeah, he does a lot wrong. Okay, there you go. I think it's really encouraging to hear the kind of the details of our lives a little bit, because people tend to think, oh man, I'm the only one that really gets, for example, morose. I'm the one that has pity parties, and Jack Crabtree, he would never do that kind of thing. And the fact is, oh yes you would.
Yeah.
Oh yes you would. And if Jody felt free to tell us, I bet she could tell us big stories on you.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And there are ways that I have hurt Jody that I still probably continue to hurt Jody that I don't even understand. I mean, that I understand the self-pity part. I mean, I understand exactly what I'm doing. But there are other ways in which I'm sure that I'm blind to my own hurtfulness. I mean, I know that's the case. And I've worked for years to try to understand how is it that I am not really being loving to Jody in the way that I should. And I still don't understand it, but I know that it's true because I see its impact on her. Maybe one day, maybe I'll understand, but I don't. And that's part of what it means, I think. We talked in the past about being poor in spirit and mourning. It's not that we have to know everything about our sinfulness, because that's a pretty big task, but to acknowledge freely that it's there, and even the parts that I don't see are there, to know that that's true, I think is an important part of understanding that I'm broken, understanding how sinful I am.
Yeah, because you could have gotten stuck on how much Jody didn't give you and really build a case for how she wasn't the kind of wife a wife should be. I'm sure you'd come up with some things that some people could agree with you on, where maybe she sincerely does fall short of maybe, like all of us, and you could kind of major on those things and never have the opportunity then to look. You're so justified, you don't have to look at the fact that you're morose. I mean, gosh, wouldn't anybody be self-pitying if they were in this kind of situation?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we go, and that's where we really get lost, and we end up not having a humbled spirit, or we end up not hungering for righteousness because we're not looking. We're not paying attention to the truth about ourselves.
Right. I'm sure you can speak to this much better than I do, but I see all the time marriages come to a standstill. What's the word I'm looking for? They get paralyzed. A stalemate. Yeah, thank you. Because each of them is building that case against the other that you just described.
Oh my heavens! I see that all the time. I just am. So what I do more and more, my husband and I have put together a model that helps people recognize different ways that we can demand of another person, that we defend against looking at ourselves, that we work at doing that. And it seems to be a very good visual for people, because we've got all these ways. There's five different categories that we have. And in fact, I was in a session recently, and these two people were warring like cats and dogs, and I just said, okay, stop. We're not going here. And I went to my board and I wrote down these areas that kind of, I think, fit most of our sinfulness into, it's kind of neat categories. It doesn't really fit that way, but it's a way for people to see it, kind of a visual. And then I I showed them these things, and I said, I don't want you to think about your wife. I don't want you to think about your husband. I want you to think about yourself. Wrote these areas down, and then I said to the husband, which ones of those are you? And give me an example of that then. Okay, so it had them focus on themselves, and then I said to the wife, what do you think? Do you agree that that's him? Yeah, those are areas, and that's correct. And she had just kind of softened because he'd finally recognized something about himself. He wasn't defending himself. He just said, oh, that's it. It just really took him by surprise that there he was up on the board. And then I turned to the wife, and I said, okay, so which ones of those are you? And she said, all of them. I can't distinguish between them. In fact, right now I'm doing, and she said it, and she goes, on the phone when we had that argument, remember that argument on the phone, honey? Remember that one? Well, I was doing this. And it's like, wow, their eyes were open, and it's such a helpful perspective, I think, to pull us back and say, okay, what are the ways that we're hurting the other person? Sometimes we need it drawn out for us pretty specifically. And I do that with my children quite often. They'll come in and say, Leah will say, Jordan's hurting me, and Jordan will say, Leah's hurting me, and both of them. And I will say to them, so nobody's guilty here, but everybody is. You know, I get a little sarcastic because I'm a tired mom sometimes, you know, and that's wrong, but I get there. And what I'll usually say to them in these arguments is, okay, Leah, I don't want to hear anything about Jordan. I want you to sit here and talk to me about what you did. What's your part? Oh, man, they really have a hard time doing that. But I think that's really an important skill for kids to learn early on. What's my role? And then, of course, I'll turn to the other one and say, okay, what did you do wrong? What was yours? So that they both get to take responsibility for what they've done.
This is sort of changing the subject, but it's related to what you're saying. You mentioned the other day, or you mentioned a few minutes ago, do pastors sin? From where I sit, of course, it seems incredible that anyone would even ask the question because, well, I mean, obviously, of course they do. On the one hand. On the other hand, I understand why that question would arise, because all of us, to a certain extent, can control our behavior not all of us. Some of us are better than others at this, but all of us attempt to monitor and guard and control our behavior in short-term public interaction. It's when we let our hair down, when we go home, when we relax, when we drop our, when we're not on our guard, that the real me comes out. And, you know, I think that's a phenomenon that I hope everybody understands and everybody relates to. I mean, it's the classic case of a husband and wife arguing, the doorbell rings, and they're all sweetness and light to one another when the doorbell rings.
You never do that, right?
Of course I do. I mean, that's just commonplace. I mean, that's where we all live.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that.
Well, there's something wrong with it in the sense that it's too bad we're that mean to each other anyway.
Right.
But there's something really right about it in terms of being kind to other people.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that for us to both take our anger out on the person who rang the doorbell is probably not the most civilized behavior. So.
Right.
In that sense, it's right, but it has a very unfortunate effect, and that is, if we're at all self-doubting, we have a tendency to buy people's public image rather than what the Bible says about them, and we can easily get the impression that other people are a lot better than I am, other people are a lot more in control than I am, other people are just more righteous than I am, and it's at that point that we need to recognize. In my own life, the difference between my private self and my public persona, and recognize that same phenomenon is true of every other human being as well. There's their private self and there's their public persona. That's why wives and children are a much better source of information about a person's character than anyone out in the public.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's our wives and our children or our husbands that see us for who we really are. If anybody does.
Yeah, I often see husbands and wives who say to me, you know, other people think I'm great. You talk to anybody at my work and they really like me. In fact, I'm kind of I'm kind of the person that takes care of conflict there, and people come to and people respect, but my husband or wife, wow, that person doesn't appreciate me. I get along with everybody else. It's got to be his or her problem. And I don't know how many thousands of times I've said, no, they're seeing a different part of you than your husband or wife is seeing. And when you get up close and personal, things change a lot. You're under a different kind of pressure. And what's real often comes out. So this is the very place. Don't leave this relationship. Because you're going to take you with you. Even if you end up leaving this relationship, at least learn who you are here. Because this person's giving you some good information, and I can almost guarantee it, if you don't learn it here, the next person you're with, you're going to do it all over again, because you're going to bring yourself with you. And they want to believe it's just their husband or their wife. Mm-hmm. And that's a tragedy. Many people have come back and said, you know, I've been married 3 times. I should have stayed with the first one because me was the problem all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pastors have a particular pressure on them. It's probably always been true, but I can only speak to our time and place and culture. Pastors feel this incredible pressure to be in control, to be right, to be impeccably righteous, to not be transparently sinful, and so that creates a tremendous temptation for them to play the part, to play the role, and to never expose themselves and be transparent. So that plays into, to the extent that they do that and play that role, then that plays into the image that pastors never sin or the pastor doesn't sin. Plus, you know, people just want that to be true of their pastor, and that's where the pressure comes from. That we want to think that this Christianity works, and what we mean by works is I can come to Jesus and it's going to automatically transform me and make me into everything that God wants me to be and everything that's right and good. Well, that would be wonderful, but it's not reality. It's not the good news that Jesus actually proclaimed. Coming to Jesus does not fix me yet. It will fix me eventually, but it doesn't fix me yet. Makes a dramatic difference in my life, but it doesn't fix me. And yet, we want somebody who's my leader to get up there and tell me Christianity fixes me and demonstrate it by showing that they're fixed in their own life. That creates a tremendous social pressure on a pastor to perform and to kind of fake it and be what he's not, or pretend to be what he's not.
Or even come to believe that he's what he's not.
And sometimes to even believe that, yeah.
And so there's this cycle that goes on that I'm hearing. It's the pastor comes to feel like he needs to be a particular polished person, and or comes to believe that he or she is, and the people expect that, and then they have the sense that they need to be that way, and so they keep pressuring the pastor to be that way and then see themselves that way, and it's just, do you see the cycle?
Yeah,
it kind of
cycle.
Goes on and on, and we're just like, how do we get out of this? Because we're all trying to look a particular way, and lots of people are coming to believe that that's truly how they are. If we look at just the superficial, and we were talking about this a lot in our program last week, if we believe that the superficial just makes us spiritual, the superficial that we do certain things like the Pharisees did, like we spend our money in a particular way, or we wear a particular kind of clothes, or we don't do certain things, like maybe we don't drink, or we just don't have... Can you come up with more examples? I'm stumbling.
We don't dance. We don't smoke. We don't go to movies. That used to be more true. Our culture has changed a little bit. I'm not sure what the modern modern indicators... I suppose the modern indicators are more not what we don't do, but what we do. I suppose it's we pray and we worship and we... those sorts of things are probably more...
And we go to church, and we have quiet times, and we have prayer groups, and we lead Bible studies, or we're in Bible studies. We tithe, or we at least give a lot. We have works of service. We certainly dress in a particular way that's rather modest. None of these things are bad. Of course, they have value. But if they become things that make us give us the measure of our spirituality, then they have become really deceptive to us.
Yeah.
Because that's how we start marking off, am I matching up to what God wants, instead of what the Beatitudes are talking about. Am I poor in spirit? That is, do I have a humble and contrite heart? And do I mourn because of that? Am I a person that feels entitled to inherit the earth, or am I a person who doesn't presume that I am entitled to anything because I have an accurate perception of the sin within me?
Right.
And then here again is, and am I a person that hungers and thirsts for righteousness? Do I want what is good? Is that really the motivating factor of my life, or is the motivating factor something that really is unrighteous?
Right, exactly. And you've begun to point out what's very important for understanding what Jesus is saying here is we have to define righteousness. What's the righteousness that we're hungering and thirsting after?
Pretty important, huh?
Yeah. There was a time in my life, a significant period in my life, where I thought righteousness was not smoking, not drinking, either not going to movies or at least watching very carefully what movies I went to.
I think you even regularly. You even couldn't play cards, right?
Well, we had cards. Yeah. We played solitaire a lot. We were rather liberal in our particular church environment. But the church environment, at least the impression that was created by the church culture that we were a part of, was very legalistic in that sense, and I really had the idea that I was righteous. I mean, as a high school student, I was very contemptuous of those morally weak kids around me who didn't have the self-control and the moral fiber to live the lifestyle that I was living. I was very contemptuous. And
I don't think I would have liked to have known you then, Jack.
I don't think so.
I like you better now.
Although, you know what? I don't know how evident that would have been on the outside. It was largely an inner attitude inside. I might not have been as obnoxious as I make myself sound because I was probably kind enough to interact with. It was my secret thoughts that were just awful, just mm-hmm. terrible. And the only reason I say that is not to defend myself, but to talk about how insidious this self-righteousness can be. I mean, we can even hide our self-righteousness from ourselves, but it's still there. I mean, it's real. And that was a big, huge lesson for me, is to come to learn that I was just like other people and that I was not a cut above. I was not made of different dust than they were. Was my salvation. I mean, if I had never learned that, I could not have become the child of God that the Beatitudes are describing. So the point is, how did I come to see that? When I stopped taking my eyes off of lifestyle choices and defining righteousness in terms of lifestyle choices and started defining it in terms of love and truth and compassion and mercy and kindness, what Jesus called the weightier matters of the law, when I started using that as the measure instead of these really fairly trivial and insignificant lifestyle choices that I thought were so important and such a mark of my righteousness.
And I imagine when you started to look at the weightier things of the law, like, am I being kind? Am I being contemptuous or loving? Am I being hateful or kind? Am I being jealous or generous? When you started looking at those things, my guess is you found out, wow, I'm being contemptuous.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being jealous. I'm being unkind. I'm being unloving.
I'm selfish. I'm greedy. I'm self-protective, I'm unkind, I'm cruel. That's what I saw.
I'm a guy that hides from the reality of looking at myself all the time. And that's when we really come to God and say, wow, this is me.
Mm-hmm.
This is me. And not in a morose way, not in a way that says, and I ought to dig a grave and put myself 50 feet under. But this is who I am, and thank be to God who has saved me and who loves me in spite of this. And that is... Because I think people could say, oh, we're just supposed to feel bad all the time. Yeah, feel bad in the sense that we mourn for that, and feel grateful in the sense that in recognizing that, what we get, what these Beatitudes say is, in recognizing those things, what he's giving us is the kingdom of heaven. We get comforted. We inherit the earth. We're satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we get out of it. Those are wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
We get the best of the best.
Yeah. This translation is perhaps a little bit unfortunate. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but the word satisfied really means sated. It's related to the word hunger. If you hunger for righteousness, you're going to be satisfied by what you get, in the same way that if I'm hungry for food, when I eat, I become full. I become satisfied. I become content. I'm no longer hungry, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I no longer hungry? Because the food that I craved, I got.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the righteousness that I crave, I'm going to get one day. It's important to see that, because what he's saying is that in the kingdom of God, you are going to be made righteous. The very thing that you lack now, the very thing that is so missing in your life that you crave having it, this godliness, this integrity, this righteousness, this wholeness, is one day going to be yours. God is going to grant that to you.
Can I ask you a question
out
of the text? I was thinking of you right now saying, one day we're going to get these things. And let me bring you to the language of the text and see if I'm hearing this right. In the first part, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, is in the present tense. It's something that the language is saying that we have now. But all the other ones say, we shall be comforted, we shall inherit the earth, for they shall be sated, they shall receive mercy, they shall, and so on. Until we get to verse 10, and it says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, which is in the present too.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of what you're saying, Jack? Is that somehow we have the kingdom of God here now, in the sense that we're promised it, but we won't have the ultimate fulfillment of those until later, because that's in the future. The shall be is in the future tense.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. When he say yours is the kingdom of heaven, he's saying you're the sort of people who are qualified to inherit the kingdom of heaven and to enter into it. The qualification is true now. The enjoyment of the kingdom of heaven is in the future. And I won't really realize the benefits of that kingdom until that kingdom is established in the age to come. Not even in this age.
I won't experience the benefit fully, but certainly there are benefits now. I mean, even just as we're talking, you realized, wow, in my Christian pilgrimage, I am less a morose person. Well, that's a really nice thing. I really like that. That's satisfying to me,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some of that comes up, and me looking at the fact that I'm willing to give up what I really want, it's satisfying to me to see, there's some change in my heart. And that's a really good thing.
Yeah. The dramatic changes happen in the lives of children of God, and those are good changes, those are positive changes, those are rewarding, those are fulfilling, they're delightful, they bring joy, but it's not the ultimate fulfillment that one day awaits us. And I think what he's ultimately trying to describe here is, why are we so lucky? Because ultimately, I'm going to have everything. Everything that reality has to offer is going to be mine. Everything that's worth anything in reality is going to be mine. And in this particular passage, in this particular beatitude, one thing that's really worth something is to have intuitive, instinctive, spontaneous righteousness where I don't even struggle with it. It's just being righteous is as natural as my heart beating. Would I like that? Not everyone would like that, but the child of God has come to see how valuable that is, that he begins to crave that kind of spontaneous righteousness. And what he's saying is, you're going to get it.
Yeah.
You're lucky, because that's going to be yours one day.
That is going to be so way cool, to not have to struggle with our sin.
Yeah.
If, I think I've said this before, but my daughter asks me sometimes, she asked me probably once a month or something, okay, Mom, if you could get anything you wanted, what would it be? And I always give her the answer that she hates. It's, you know what I'd like? I'd like to not sin anymore. I'd like to be a person that's never mean to you. Okay, Mom, not that, but something else, something more interesting than that.
Something more worldly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to say, people might listen to this 10 years from now and think my daughter is, it'll be unfortunate. My daughter is 10, so she has I think there's every reason for her to be young.
Yeah.
She is very young. I'd like to tie this passage, what we're saying, into another passage. And I'm not good at knowing where things are. Maybe you can help me out here, Jack, but it's a passage that says, the sufferings of this present age aren't even worthy to be compared to what we're going to get in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That is...
Romans 8.
What verse are we in?
It's in verse 18 of chapter 8. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. The anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope, for why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it.
That's it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that what he's talking about, the satisfaction that's to come, is what he's calling glory that is to be revealed to us in chapter 8. And our position in this life is to wait eagerly for it in hope, and by hope, whenever we run across that word hope in the Bible, we need to get rid of our English idiom. Our idiom is, boy, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow as I see the clouds rolling in. I hope it doesn't rain. We're saying, I wish that wouldn't be the case. It's not just wishful thinking here that the Bible is talking about. Hope is the eager, confident expectation that what God has promised is going to come to pass. So, with perseverance, we wait eagerly, confidently, that what God has promised me is one day going to be mine. Namely, I'm going to be glorious with the very glory of the godliness of God himself. I'm going to be awesomely righteous, awesomely holy, as God is holy.
And you really hear the struggle, though, of the here and now. It says the anxious longing of creation. We're waiting for the revealing of God. We're subjected to futility. We're going to be set free from slavery to corruption. That means we're in slavery to corruption today.
Mm-hmm.
That the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth. You know, we're in a heap of trouble here. There's a lot that's not good about here, and I think that's what we've been talking about.
Right.
If we really open our eyes, we see that there's a big problem in the creation and in ourselves, in the people around us, and to see that clearly is to give us a hope for something that's really good, to give us a hope for what we need most, which is this eternity where we're not enslaved to the corruption of our own hearts and our own souls.
Right, that's right. Just one final comment, maybe. This beatitude, one of the things about this beatitude that's very helpful, I think, is that it really makes it clear that these things that characterize a child of God are not only at the level of my perceptions and at the level of my beliefs and at the level of my attitudes, but at the level of my very passions. Because hunger and thirst is a desire. It's at the level of what drives me, what passions drive me. It's a passion for righteousness. It's a craving for righteousness. It's a longing for righteousness that is one day going to be fulfilled. So what the spirituality that the Beatitudes are describing, it's not just attitudinal. It's not just how I look at the world, how I perceive the world, but it's what I want. It's a question of what desires will ultimately win out and what desires ultimately drive me. And that's, I think that's clear in this one, because there's no other way to understand hunger and thirst other than as a drive and a passion.
That comes from deep within.
Yeah.
So you're making a distinction between an attitude, which I think we often think of as pretty deep. If I have an attitude toward you that's positive, then there's something about me there can be something about me that's kind of deeply committed to seeing who you are. It also could be I just want to be a positive thinker. But you're talking about something even deeper than an attitude that comes out of my heart. There's a passion that wants something.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm contrasting the depth of them. I think my attitudes can be very deep, but I'm just saying spirituality is multifaceted. All of it is deep, but some of them are my deep down attitudes. Some is deep down, what do I think? Some of it is deep down, what do I see? But some of it is deep down, what do I want? And it's really all those things. What do I want? What do I think? What do I see? Mm-hmm. That really goes into making my spirituality what it is. But it includes, what do I want, is what I'm saying.
Okay. And it's anything but superficial.
Yeah, none of it's superficial. Right.
Don't go away. Jack and Christine will continue the discussion in just a moment. You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help, and you'll get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program.
Over the last year or year and a half, many of you listeners have given us your response either by letter or by phone, and it's overwhelming and touching to see the ways in which our discussions and our conversations and our research into biblical Christianity has been liberating to you and has been healing to you and has helped you in the ways that it has. I must say, from my own experience in the ministry and in education, I must say that those of you who are listening to us and benefiting by what we're having to say are very likely in the minority, not only in the minority in American culture, but probably in the minority in church culture as well. Throughout all of church history, biblical truth has ultimately been unattractive and uninteresting to mankind. It is only a few, it is only some, who have been touched by the Spirit of God, who recognize and acknowledge the truth that is in this biblical Christianity that we're trying to expound. I say that just to point out that the potential base of supporters to support this program financially is really relatively small. There are a large number of people with vast resources who will not be interested in a program like ours, because some of what we're going to say on this program is a little jarring, a little different, a little unfamiliar, and a little threatening to most of the people who are comfortable in the Christian culture in this nation. So those of you who are responding, and those of you who are interested, and those of you who find this in some way refreshing, we would just appeal to you to consider whether you might not help us stay on the air by sending us your financial contributions.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center,
Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.